History and Culture Podcasts are a production of PCN, a nonprofit television network. Listeners like you make our programming possible. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit pcntv.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
Welcome to PCN's History and Culture Podcast. I'm Phil Beckman. This podcast series features interviews exploring Pennsylvania's rich history from the colonial era to industrialization, the Gettysburg Campaign to sports history, and from art to politics and more.
We are joined today by Gene Wainwright, Professor Emeritus at the University for the Creative Arts in England. Andy Warhol is considered one of the best-known pop artists. Which of his work do you think best represents him as an artist?
Well, I love that question. It's interesting because I would say, of course, best represents him. Perhaps the best knowns are the soup cans and the Marilyns and the flowers. However, what best represents him, I sometimes think, are some of his films and some of his drawings, in a sense that they perhaps show a side of him, a very human side, that perhaps isn't so obvious in those very particular and well-known pop works.
Now, Andy Warhol was born Andrew Warhola on August 6, 1928 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. How did his upbringing inspire some of his art?
It definitely inspired his art. Pittsburgh was very important as a breeding ground for his ideas. And of course, a lot has been talked about of how he came from immigrant parents who had come to America, and really he fulfilled the American dream. You know, there was a lot of poverty, but of course, the thrift of the family saving up, they owned their own home when Warhol was six in Dawson Street. So they moved swiftly from, you know, almost like very poor dwellings to actually owning their own house. And his aesthetic was very much toned by the working and hard work of his parents, and particularly his mother, because his father died when he was a teenager. And she saved everything. She was thrifty. She made things. And that aesthetic and his surroundings very much informed his early art. And actually, it all started in Pittsburgh, really. And those things he learned there never really left him, I don't think. Particularly religion, church going, things like that as well.
What drew him to art initially?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think it was partly his mother set up drawing competitions at the kitchen table to keep the three boys, because he had two older brothers, amused. And so that was one influence. Secondly, he suffered from Sidman's cholera, a childhood illness that confined him to bed. And his mother again would give him things to cut out from magazines. And then again, I think he was visually interested in everything. So I think that definitely is what formed his certainly early art, yes. So he was always, and probably, I mean, obviously Pittsburgh and in the Depression years when he was growing up was definitely a steeler town, coal mining. And it was pretty obvious early on that he wasn't going to work in heavy industry as well.
As he got older, he went to college. Where did he go and what did he study?
So he went to Carnegie Tech and he studied a very interesting course at pictorial design. And what was fascinating about that was it was kind of not so much fine art based, although there was fine art in it. It was really teaching the students to be able to earn a living. So they learned how to express themselves artistically, but how to also take on commissions. It was in a way based on the kind of Bauhaus School of Design, where you tried different methods and then you worked at those and you learned about techniques and things like that. So it was a very good grounding for him, particularly to go into illustration. He had some inspirational teachers there as well, which certainly helped, I think.
What was Andy Warhol's first job out of college?
Well, the first job out of college is quite interesting. He went to live in New York in 1949, went to New York, and he very quickly got illustration work. He got work on Glamour magazine. But again, being Warhol, he was very distinctive. You know, you didn't really forget him, whether it was the anecdotal stories of a cockroach coming out of his homemade portfolio or giving clients little hand-illustrated books. So he quickly got known for his rather quirky drawings and being able to take instructions, being able to do what clients wanted for, you know, for the illustrations. So it became very popular very quickly.
What were some of the different styles that Andy Warhol used in his art in his early years?
Well, there were many different ways that he approached. So there was drawing. There was also a dotted line technique. Now, that was a really clever idea of Warhol's. And that's where you attached a piece of paper, drew round what you'd drawn in ink, and then folded the paper over so you could make a copy of it. So right from the beginning, he's thinking of how he could produce more than one work. That was what he used, marbling in the background of his works. He, in the show that I've got on at the moment, in Newlands House Gallery in Petworth, we've got lovely early examples of drawings where there are bits of old tape where he's actually run out of paper and, you know, added a bit more paper. So that goes back to the thrifty background, but also to his trying out of different techniques. He used stencils, he used stamps, you know, stamps that he would make multiples of butterflies and things. So right from the beginning, he's using a lot of different techniques.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning two of his most notable pieces, which are the Campbell soup cans and the Shot Marilyns. Those involve repetition. How did he get into repetition in his art?
Well, again, you know, much anecdotal evidence, but also what he loved was the idea of lots and lots of things. And that came lots of the same thing. And that came almost from production line and thinking of how things are produced, so he could have lots of the same things for people to see in different colorways. Also, it's interesting that although for Marilyns, he made many, 450 of his flowers, multiple Marilyns, but all using the same image. Now that's quite interesting, the same image, different colorways, different iterations. But also people have talked about how there were three cinemas in Pittsburgh that he went to as a child. And in the cinema, you think of the images going through the frame. And as a child, he had a little toy projector. And he was aware of how animation worked and frames worked, which were lots of the same image, slightly altered. So I guess there were lots of ways that we could think of those early inspirations.
As we said earlier, Andy Warhol was a pop artist. Can you explain what the pop art movement was?
So the pop art movement really comes from popular subject matter, easily accessible to people, often about something that was very simple, as I say, a cute soup can, a Brillo box. So the pop art movement, although it involved quite a few artists, was about taking cartoon characters, taking household objects, using everyday things to make work. And that was very different from the presiding art movement that came before, the abstract expressionists, which were all about, you know, one man usually in the environment making this incredible work about themselves, their interior selves. And his was the opposite of that. So it was to communicate something. And as he said, you know, about his Coke work, you know, the president can drink a Coke, I can drink a Coke, Andy Warhol can drink a Coke, they're all the same Coke. So he was really interested in that, bringing it down to the level of everybody being able to understand it.
Did the pop art movement reflect something that was going on culturally at the time?
Yes, there was so much happening, of course, in the 1960s, as we know. There was a huge shift between the 50s and the 60s, both culturally, sexually, everything. We had the youth quake. We had a shift in society. It's the time of consumer goods becoming much more readily available for the, you know, people working in the home. They could have a soup can rather than having to make soup. There were all the new appliances coming out, often used in pop art. So there was a real shift. And obviously for Warhol, he was very aware of all those shifts, whether and reflected them in his art, whether it was race riots, which he actually made work of in the 60s, the sexual things that were happening. So there were many, many things that were going on that he was very aware of. He looked at newspapers all the time. He took references from Time magazine, from the New York Times. He really did study from photographs that he saw. So he actually was very on the button of the cultural things that were happening and kind of picked things that he felt would communicate what people were going through and feeling.
You mentioned Andy Warhol's films, and I'm sure a lot of people may not be familiar with the fact that he made films as well as physical art pieces. Could you talk about what some of those projects of his were?
Well, he made many projects, starting with things like film tests, screen tests, where you sat, rather like we're sitting in front of a screen and tried to keep as still as you could, silently for 3 minutes. So there were those works, but there were also the much longer films. The Chelsea Girls, we think of, some people might know Empire, so 8 hours of the Empire State Building. Then we have his kind of boyfriend, John Giorno, sleeping. And again, in my exhibition, have a wonderful film called Mrs. Hamilton, which was done in 1966. And it's of Andy Warhol's mother, and she's playing a murderess with the character. She's playing the murderess character, but she's acting with Warhol's boyfriend at the time, Richard Rheem. And it's a wonderful film, very rarely screened. And people might not even know these kind of really interesting works. It's part of a trilogy. And so Warhol was also interested in ordinary, again, the ordinary, somebody eating a banana or a mushroom or kissing. And they're really interesting to watch because they've got zooms, they engage with the faces, their portraits. So they're really interesting. Then they change rather after his shot, but that's a whole another story. They go in a different direction. There's more narrative and storytelling than in the early ones.
In the 1960s, Andy Warhol created The Factory. What was it and how did it impact his career?
Well, The Factory had three factory spaces, but the one you're talking about, 1963 to 1968, was really, really important. So Billy Names sprayed the walls silver. We know that was all covered with silver foil. And that was where the activities happened, the screen printing, the films. And it was a melting pot for all different people, as you probably heard from people from uptown, from downtown. And when I say that, I mean celebrities, people off the streets, heiresses, they'd now be trust fund kids. They all came to the factory. Many of them brought their own problems with them. And until Warhol was shot in 68, really the only criteria for being allowed in was that you had your film portrait done. But it was a very important working environment as well. And at any one time, Warhol would have his audio recorder, he'd be recording what people said, there'd be somebody on the telephone, he installed a payphone, there would be a film going on, there'd be screen printing going on. So it was like this hub of activity, often collaboration, so people were helping with screen prints, different people were in the films, there was a kind of core group of superstars, as he called them, a wonderful name. And so that was really an important place for, you know, and I think, you know, talking to many people as I have done, and I've got many photographs in the exhibition I curated, which shows the factory and shows the people, you know, had he encouraged photographers to come there. And so there were photographers who were professional photographers and amateur photographers. So it's great. We've got so many references to what was happening at the factory at the time. And I don't think we've any other example in all different media of a kind of a society, what was happening in society, what was happening in alternative society, and then what was happening in that space of time from 63 to 68. He always called his spaces the factory. So he had two more after that.
Can you talk a little bit more about the assassination attempt that he survived in 1968?
Yes, this was really unfortunate. Valerie Solanas, who had written a manifesto called the Scum Manifesto, the Society for Cutting Up Men, she had worked with Andy. And she'd been in he had cast her in a film, Iron Man, and she'd given him a script that she had written. And Andy lost it, apparently. Well, we're not quite sure whether he lost it or whether he thought that perhaps it was, she was trying to get him into trouble because it was pretty hardcore. And she came into the factory, she had a gun, and she went up in the elevator. And then she came out of the elevator and she shot him. And that was a catastrophic event for Warhol. He remembered actually waking up, being aware and hearing somebody said he's a goner, really. They managed to get him to the hospital in time and they repaired in a long operation. Obviously everything that, you know, had happened to him, the penetration, the bullet and everything, leaving only a hernia that he lived with for the rest of his life. And that was only repaired in the final operation he had, which of course he didn't recover from and died in the hospital, New York Hospital. So this event really did have an impact on his future health. Of course it did. And in fact, there's a lovely Gerard Malanga portrait of Warhol in 1971. Valerie was actually released from a short time from prison, and she allegedly phoned him up. And so obviously that must have really scared him. So it was, she said, she handed herself in. She said he had too much control over my life. And I suppose, you know, it was a very scary event. And he was in hospital for a long time. He was frail for a long time. And I think that it made him more cautious, less able to have just everybody around him. Although he still went out all the time, went to parties, and that silver factory kind of time, if you like, ended with the shooting.
Andy Warhol was a gay man living through the 1960s to the 1980s. How was life for him as a gay man at that time?
Well, I think this is such an interesting question because for me, Andy, literally, it was very brave. You know, it was very difficult to be gay then. People forget how hard it was. But he kind of hid in plain sight. He, you know, wore his wig, his glasses. He didn't shy away from having relationships and kind of filming, doing films that could be considered, you know, doing drawings of men and, well, men of penises, of all these things. And yet somehow he managed to navigate that landscape pretty well. And if you think about it, not only, you know, he was 40 in 1968. So not only did he come from Pittsburgh, then goes to New York, he kind of is a gay man having relationships. But then in the 80s, the catastrophic AIDS crisis really, really affected him as well. He saw many people die. He saw people that he knew well die. And indeed, his last relationship with John Gould, Unfortunately, John died of AIDS, and this traumatized Warhol. And so there were, you know, there was much sadness about that. And it must have been a terrible time for him to see these glorious young men that he had been, you know, around and had inspired his art, and he'd seen as ballet dancers, as wonderful photographers, as artists die. So I think for him, there was always conflicts. When you read his diaries, there's many, many poignant points there where he talks about, does someone like him or not? And, you know, and he did have relationships. How intimate they are, is, again, is a source of debate always. But I think that he managed somehow to make work that both responded to that, but also work that had nothing to do with that at all. You know, there are many, many things of his art you could look at, and they have nothing to do with actually his sexuality. So it's quite an interesting point. And I think when you see the Mrs. Hamilton story, and you see his mother relating to Richard Ream, his boyfriend, and how it's such a lovely, intimate relationship. And you kind of think, well, this is really great to see this, you know. And I think that, again, it shouldn't define him, because I don't think he did consider it defining him particularly. His art defined him. His work defined him. His work ethic, his fascinating for every single different media, whether film or illustration or computer art, all those things, you know, defined him as well as how he lived his life.
Andy Warhol died in 1987. What lasting legacy did he leave on the art world?
He left such a lasting legacy. I don't think there's any artist in history where every day there's some kind of citation, you know, oh, Andy Warhol would have embraced the internet age, the Instagram age, the TikTok generations. He really had such, I mean, from his phrases, like 15 minutes of fame, and it's always fascinated me that a man who supposedly said so little, we've got so many of his quotes that we can see and read, but also so many artists he influenced. And actually, again, in my exhibition, I've got Robin Nick Carter, I've got Philip Kolber, I've got Gavin Turk, and I could have had many, many other artists. There have been so many artists that have been directly or indirectly influenced by him. And it's really the fact that he took things around him and made art. People have then imitated his art. And of course, he also was a magpie. He took, you know, appropriated images from other people. So there's that wonderful kind of chain reaction, I think. And people love pop art. They love the colors. They love the kind of expression of it. Like, they love, you know, from Lady Gaga saying that Warhol was an influence to Debbie Harry, to as so many artists have been influenced by him.
Lastly, what drew you to want to study Andy Warhol?
Well, I was very interested in the YBAs, the Young British Artists in Britain, and it turned out that many of them had been very aware of Warhol. And I knew that Warhol had left a lot of audio tapes behind, and I was very interested in those. There are over 4,000 of them, and no one had ever studied them. So I thought, I'm going to do my doctoral thesis on those. So in the 90s, I came to Pittsburgh and started listening to them. Sadly, they're embargoed, as you probably know. And I met his family, his brothers, nieces, nephews, who were all in Pittsburgh. And I loved Pittsburgh. I loved the family. I really felt connected to Warhol. I felt connected to what had influenced him, looking at all these areas that had kind of had an influence on his work, but also the familial things, how much influence his parents, particularly his mother, as I say, his relationship with his brothers, how that has all impacted on him. And I just couldn't stop. I kind of, you know, so I did my doctorate. I sadly couldn't publish from it because of the problems that later the tapes were withdrawn from circulation. But I continued being fascinated by him as a man, and all the time, I still discover things now. And I was fascinated by, you know, how he looked at brands and how, you know, although he did Campbell Soup Can, Pittsburgh was the house of Heinz, the home of Heinz. I was like, well, that's so Andy Warhol, you know. So I think there were so many things, yes. And I went to the church where he worshipped as a child. I went round with John Warhola, sadly not with us now. He would drive me around Pittsburgh, showing me all the sites where he'd studied. So it really gave me an intimate, I flew back and forth to Pittsburgh. It gave me an intimate connection, really, with Warhol and the work and Pittsburgh.
We've been speaking with Jean Wainwright, Professor Emeritus at the University for the Creative Arts in England. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Listeners like you make PCN programming possible. Full episodes of PCN's history and culture content, like the interview you just heard, are available to stream with the PCN Select app. Explore other documentary programs, event coverage, and a lot more. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit pcntv.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.